from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello and welcome, and thank you for joining us and clicking the subscribe button. It's much appreciated. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen. And joining me, much like the rest of Scotland, he hasn't shouted out freedom last week. Yochai Elam, how are you doing, Yochai?
Hi, Lior, how are you doing? Yeah, I'm doing great. Yeah, no freedom and no rest for the wicked.
Yeah, no rest for the wicked, and we have a busy week ahead of us, and also a lot of it on this today's show. We're going to talk about the perils of contango in the energy market. We have an update from last week's Scotland referendum. Well, I alluded to the fact a little bit earlier, and a major U.S. economic report that will shape the U.S. dollar. So let's kick it off with the perils of contango and the benefits of backwardation in the energy market.
What is contango and backwardation?
When people seek to invest in, let's say, in oil or natural gas or any other commodity, they have several options, right? They can buy options. They can in the future market. They can buy related companies, such as if you're talking about oil, you can talk about BP, Exxon, Chevron, all these kind of companies that produce oil, or trade it in the Forex and the commodities platforms, or buy a USO, which is an ETF, an exchange traded fund that follows the price of oil. Now, before I get into contango and backwardation, so just I want to refer to that with respect to USO, for instance, because I'll take that as an example. So this is the ETF that follows the price of oil. Now, how does USO, which is the United States oil, operate? It tries to follow the price of oil by purchasing next month's contracts of the oil market. So that's how it follows oil, and people who want to follow oil instead of buying futures or just obviously directly buying oil, they can just follow and purchase in the stock market the USO.
That sounds quite simple and straightforward.
Yeah, it sounds very simple. It's pretty straightforward. Of course, there are a little bit of problems. For one thing, you have to take into account that it has some commission costs, and the other hand, could have some perils from the contango in the energy market. So
that's where things become just a bit more complicated, don't they?
And to be honest, before I go into it, I'll just say that when I first talked about it in one of the websites, one of the major financial websites that I contribute content to, I won't say names, when I told them about this issue I'm not a trailblazer, I'm not a pioneer, it's something that's pretty ubiquitous, and people who are delving into this matter, they know about it. When I told them about it and I wrote an article about this kind of thing in the natural gas market, they dismissed it and they didn't allow me to present it. They said, "Oh, you're talking silly. That doesn't occur. Well, what are you talking about?" Only when I showed them that this thing actually happens, and not only that even in the prospectus of UNG, which follows the natural gas, or USO, they actually have an entire section about this contango backwardation issues, only then they allow me to publish my article. So contango is the definition. If you go to the definition, it's a situation where future price of oil is above the expected future spot price. So this means that the current price of oil, the price that if you want to purchase it at the current markets, is marked lower than the price of oil in the future. This means that people who want to buy oil, say in a few months from now, they'll have to pay a higher price than people who want to buy oil now. Now you say, oh, that probably makes sense. No, it's probably that in all commodities. Well, no. In certain situations, you have the reverse. And in effect, now, if you look into the future markets, you'll see that it's the other way around. So in the oil market currently, we have a thing called backwardation. So it's not the contango, it's the other way around, where oil prices are marked lower in the future than they are in the present. So this is kind of an indication for us that people expect oil prices to come down, and as such, the oil prices are marked lower in the future than they are in the present.
Oh, finally, I get to understand these complex definitions. Thanks.
We'll take an example. So now we see the oil price is around $94 per barrel. It represents the price of near month, this is near month, we say for October. We're now in September. So the price of the next month afterwards for November is around $93. So this means it's 1% cheaper the near month, the month for November, than it is for October. So under certain conditions, without considering accounting for the commission that I talked, and also these kind of ETFs, USO and UNG also hold a lot of cash accounts, and they have they get paid for that also. But excluding these issues, USO, for instance, investors could see that their investment will fall at a slower pace than the price of spot oil if we are in backwardation. Or on the other hand, USO may rise at a faster pace. So what happened? USO, they hold the near-term contracts, right? Most of their contracts are future contracts. It cannot hold actual barrels of oil because, yeah, where are you going to store a lot of barrels? You just rely on the future markets, right? You cannot do that. That's, by the way, as opposed to other commodities such as a GLD or SLV. These ETFs follow gold and silver respectively, and they actually do hold hoards of gold and silver. Well, and that makes sense because, you know, it's much easier to hold gold bars than to hold barrels of oils, right?
So it's backed by the physical thing.
Yes, so that's why they don't have. So that's why they don't have these kind of issues of contango, backwardation. They don't have to deal with that because they actually hold gold and silver. So they follow the price of gold and silver to the exact. In the oil market, in the oil and in natural gas, they rely on futures. And as such, when they want to roll the contracts, because when they get to the end of the month, they don't want to exercise the futures. They have to roll it to the next month. They have to start buying the next month's contracts. This kind of roll entails that if the price is marked, next month's price is a little bit lower, such as in the oil market, which is because we're in backwardation. So in that case, USO has to buy oil at a cheaper price, right? The futures buys it at a cheaper rate. So in such a case, they get a little bit of a premium, and their investors could see that they will represent it in their price, in the USO price, that will either rise a little bit faster than oil or fall a little bit slower. And let me take you a current example. I just draw this chart. If we look at the normalized prices of USO and the WTI, we will see that they are normalized to the end of July. So we had a little bit of a month and a half or so. We'll see that the USO fell by roughly 6% and up to now, and the WTI fell by roughly 7%. So because each month USO has to rebuy contracts for the next month, because all they hold, besides a little bit of besides cash, they also hold contracts for the next month. That's it. And every month they have to start buying again for the next month to remain in the same position. So every time that they buy it a little bit cheaper, as long as we're in backwardation. And as such, they roll over these kind of savings, and it represented with oil with the USO falling a little bit slower than WTI, as we saw in this kind of situation.
So the gap is maintained, basically.
Yeah, the gap is maintained. It depends on what happens in the future markets. If we'll suddenly see a sharp rise in the backwardation, and suddenly people will expect oil prices to fall much harsher in the near term, in the next few months or so, we could see that the USO will outperform by a higher margin the oil price, the spot price of WTI. Now, on the other hand, if we'll take the natural gas market, the situation is reverse. And over there, we see that UNG is underperforming natural gas. And why is that? Because the current expectations are that the price of natural gas will start rising in the coming months, right? Because we're entering in the few months, we'll be in winter time. And there is also this kind of seasonality means that the demand in natural gas will rise. And as such, we see that natural gas is in contango in the future markets. And as such, UNG, whenever it rolls its contracts to the next month, it buys it at a bit higher price. You can see it that the UNG will underperform natural gas prices. So we have that to consider. This kind of a process, it's normally called roll decay, because they roll the contracts every month, so they have a little bit of decay because they are in contango. This is something that people should be aware of whenever they purchase the ETFs that follow commodities that are based on the future markets.
So it can basically erode if it's in contango.
Yes, so it could erode when it's in a contango. It could do a little bit better when it's in backwardation. These factors should also be taken into account. Now, obviously, if you just do it for a very short period, the erosion won't be so harsh because, as I said, it's usually when they roll the contract. So these kind of things doesn't have much of an impact on a very short period of time, but it does have. It could have much of an impact over a longer period of time. So people who purchase UNG or USO should be aware of it, that there is also a matter of seasonality. And I think in the future, we'll also dedicate the contango backwardation in the US, in the oil market versus in the natural gas market, and give some more
actionable trading options for both contango and backwardation. You can have some opportunities to trade on it as well.
Yes, and also the situation, and give some actual examples of what happens when it does occur, and the matter of seasonality, and there's a lot of issues to explore in these kind of factors, but I just want to throw it out there because I think it's something that not everybody are on board with it, and we'll explore it again in the future episodes, I think. So that's that. We'll have to go back to what happened last week, and we had a big announcement, so you're not gonna be all Mel Gibson on me and start shouting freedom, right? So there's that, and I was really looking forward to it. So the polls were very close when it comes to the Scottish referendum, but eventually the final vote wasn't so, right?
Yeah, eventually we had a clear majority against independence. It was around 55% against, 44 for independence. That's a clear result, a turnout of around 84-85%. No doubts, the leader of the Scottish National Party resigned afterwards, Alex Salmond, so it seems it's all over, and that's it. But wait. First of all, let's look at what happened around the referendum. So we had a huge fall in the value of the pound around when the polls began showing a chance for a yes victory. Now, we had a fall from 166 to around 160.50. And around the big event, we also had some wild action. We had when the first county or region declared, it was Clackamannanshire, I hope I'm saying it correctly.
Oh man, you're so butchering it.
Yeah, I'm sure I am. Apologies to our Scottish friends. Anyway, it's a small region and they were expected to vote yes, and the result was no. So the reaction in the pound, even though it was early in the Asian session, was a sharp rise. Markets began pricing in a clear yes vote, and we had the pound dollar rise up to 165.20. And as the night progressed and we got more and more results, we saw the pound eroding, like with the contango and backwardation. We had some erosion in the pound. And
oh, there we go.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And that kind of situation, there were big swings. As you said, there were big swings in the British pound last week. And eventually, after, I know that you'll get to it, but I also want you also to say, eventually it just came back to where it started, or did it reach a new low, a new high? Something came out of it? That's what I'm trying to allude.
Yes, the pound dollar is eventually lower than it was before early September, before polls began showing a closer race.
So even though this Scottish referendum eventually didn't lead to any major change, it still had a major change in the British pound.
Right, but if we look at Euro pound or pound Aussie or things like that, we don't see the pound losing so much ground because at the same time we had a strengthening of the US dollar. So if we focus only on pound dollar, we see that it fell from previous levels from around 166 to around 163 something at the time of this recording. But if we look at Euro pound, it's around the same levels of around 79.
But on the other hand, the US dollar rallied against most currencies anyway. We cannot know if it's more of an actual impact from the Scottish referendum or something from the British economy.
Yeah, so we had lots of things going on at the same time. Strengthening of the US dollar, a weakening of the euro, weakening of the yen, trillion dollar that held quite well for quite some time but then collapsed.
So it's a lot of moving parts, but what do you think? You think it actually had some sustainable impact that that this Scottish reform left in the British pound, or not?
Yeah, I think the pound was still left a bit scarred, at least against the dollar, from this event. If beforehand we saw the Bank of England moving before the Fed, thus allowing the pound to strengthen against the dollar, clearly now the pound is behind. In addition, a good result for traders is that volatility hasn't gone away. So we had extreme volatility around the event. We had the, when the first result came out, we saw strengthening of the pound, and then when the actual official result came out, the pound continued falling and falling around over 200 pips from the peak. I believe that eventually the good-looking UK economy will lead to an early rate hike and will lead to strengthening of the pound, even against the strong US dollar, but that's still to be seen.
Can you put this kind of eventually it went the way, you know, David Cameron wanted to, so can he put it in the win column?
I'm not so sure, because when the race became closer, David Cameron and his colleagues began panicking, and they offered Scotland lots of things, more a devolution, max devolution of powers to the Scottish Parliament, and that raised a lot of questions, because he didn't get any support for that from the back benches of the Conservative Party, and also the Labour Party went far with promises, and even though Alex Salmond has resigned, the Scottish people, and there are about 44% that voted to leave the UK, I think they will still demand to get what they were promised. And also those that voting for yes, relying on these promises, will want these promises to be made, become reality. So, okay, for the meantime, the topic is off the agenda, because we heard from the leaders that another Scottish referendum on independence is off for at least one generation or for a lifetime. However, if the Scots don't get what they were promised, we could have this thing return to the agenda in a year or two.
Oh, so it's not completely off the ballot. So we still have it on the table. Maybe if it's down the line, but it's still something that could pop up in the coming years.
Yeah. So for those who trade markets for short and medium term, it's totally off the agenda, but for the long term, it's on the back burner, and it could come back to the forefront quite soon. It's something to be aware of. At the moment, it calmed down fears about other separatist regions like Catalonia. It calmed down fears that the UK would leave the EU, because Scottish people are more pro-Europe, and Scots voted big time for Labour, which also wants to stay in the European Union. So now there's a higher chance that Labour will win in elections, or that if David Cameron wins once again with the Conservatives, and he will proceed with the referendum, in-out referendum on Europe, the vote will be no. So these things are off the agenda. Prospect for interest rate hikes are still there for the spring, but this topic could rise once again. And another thing, as I've mentioned before, I think that volatility is here to stay with the British pound against the US dollar, and against other currencies.
Now, why is that?
Because it's quite unclear who will raise rates earlier, the Fed or the Bank of England. And as long as the uncertainty exists and the speculation goes on, I think we'll have more action between these currencies.
So we saw that even though the Scottish referendum had a sharp impact, as it seems, on the British pound, it may have also kicked it off to remain so, and not because of the what happened in Scotland, but because of the current economic environment and the now, as you said, the race between Bank of England compared to the FOMC and who will raise rates again. And this question also raises the next meeting we have of the MPC is not far away, and
yeah, it's in early October.
Yeah, and we'll talk about it obviously when we get along to it. But I'll just want your opinion. So, do you think that we'll see some major news from the MPC now that could shape up the British pound, as was the case in the FOMC? Because they didn't take much, they didn't talk much about the FOMC, they didn't bring up much big news, but we saw big swings for the US dollar. So could this kind of thing happen also for the British pound next week?
Yeah, I think the Bank of England will surely talk about the Scottish referendum, and we'll see that in the meeting minutes in mid-October at some point, that it at least they'll mention that it removed some kind of uncertainty for markets, and I think this could be a bullish sign for the British pound that things are moving forward towards a rate hike. So we could see some kind of reference from the Monetary Policy Committee and Mark Carney. In general, I think that there's a lot more focus on the pound now in markets, and the volatility we've seen around the Scottish referendum is here to stay, especially in this contest with the Fed, but also against the other currencies which are weaker, the euro, the Aussie, the Kiwi, and also the yen. All of these are currently falling against the dollar, and we'll see when the pound is ahead of the dollar, the pound crosses could leap much stronger than the majors. So I think we have this interesting situation related to the Scottish referendum and related to the interest rate hike. And the Scottish referendum just added a lot of spice to pound trading, and I think it's here to stay.
All right, that's cool. And okay, so from Scotland, we'll move back to the US, and we have some major economic reports, most notably the GDP for the final estimate for the GDP for the second quarter. There'll be that final, the third and final estimate. And in the previous one, if I'm not mistaken, it showed that the GDP grew by 4.2%. How does this estimate may impact the US dollar, and what's the current expectations from this for the final estimate?
Well, the expectations stand on an upgrade to 4.6%. This is based on economic figures released in recent weeks, related to some figures for June, the last month of the second quarter. What I like about the US GDP releases is first of all, there are three in some countries. There's only one or two. And that each one has a significant impact, contrary to the UK, for instance, that also has three, but only the first one has a really strong impact. So, if we'll get around 5%, it'll be really bullish for the US dollar. If we get no change or even a downgrade, it'll be bearish. If it'll be 4.6 or 4.4, 4.8, I think it will be have a small impact, but that's I've seen on some economic calendars and some analysts that disregard this publication, and I think it's very important, so we should watch out. And it'll of course impact the forecast for the whole year, and the Fed also looks at the whole year, so the final number will have an impact, especially after we had a contraction of 2.1% annualized in Q1.
Yeah, so that was a big big turn of events from the first quarter to the second quarter. And does it mean that this kind of big shift, does it mean that we'll have maybe something the same similar in the third quarter? Or
no, I don't see the US economy bouncing back and forth. The first quarter was marred by extremely harsh weather, and the second quarter was a big rebound. I think that now we'll see growth rates of around 2.5%, 3% in the third and fourth quarters. So eventually, I believe the year will end with a growth rate of 2.5%, something like that.
So it's pretty stable. So it's pretty stable for what happened the past couple of years or so.
Yeah,
so
marginally above stall rate, or marginally self-sustained. That's what I would call it.
Yeah, so it's not much. Yeah, as you said, and if you take into account that there's population growth of what, around 1%, you take that in account, so that's roughly 1.5% growth.
Yeah, just a bit above stall speed.
Yeah, it's not much to look at, but it will be, if we will see suddenly a sharp rise, not expected, but if we'll see suddenly a sharp rise, it could also, for one, change, as you said, the Fed's estimates for the year, and also maybe turn the Fed a little bit more hawkish, because they say, the economy is doing much better.
Right. We'll see new forecasts from the Fed only in December, but of course, the final GDP read for Q2 has an impact on forecasts, especially forecasts for 2014, which are already halfway through.
Yeah, so not much of a forecast left.
Yeah, forecasts are usually more accurate if they relate to the past and not the future.
Yeah. So. Okay, so we have that. It's not, as you said, it's the third one, so probably the third might have a smaller impact than what the first and the second had. But still, it's something that's worth noticing. It could have some prominence, especially in this week, because we don't have big major economic reports. It's not like what happened last week when we had the Fed and the Scottish referendum. So this is a relatively slower week compared to what happened last week. So it could have some more, take a little bit more of the center stage.
Yeah, in wider terms, I would say that if we have the 5% handle, it'll be bullish. If we have 3 or less, it'll be bearish. And if we have 4 point something, it'll be stable.
All right, that's cool. And well, besides that, we have some other additional economic reports to worth noticing.
Yeah, well, we have the weekly jobless claims. Of course, that's weekly and we don't always talk about it, but we did see something interesting last week. After jobless claims began an uptrend and we could really draw some nice lines on the jobless claims chart, any other technical analysis, we saw it rising to around 315,000. We saw it falling back down to 280,000. That's around the 8-year lows, levels last seen in 2006. But this could be a one-off. So this week, jobless claims are interesting to watch because they will either confirm or ruin the theory that jobless claims are falling once again. So that will be interesting to watch. And also the 4-week moving average is of high importance. It fell just below 300,000 last week, and we'll have to see if this is sustained. So that's another important figure. And we have also this week more housing figures, and housing figures haven't been that exciting recently. So last week we had disappointing building permits, disappointing housing starts. They both fell below the 1 million mark annualized. This week so far we had existing home sales, which also came out at 5.06 million. They came at 5.05 million, just under expectations. But perhaps the most interesting figure in the housing market is still ahead of us, and that's new home sales. Even though it's a smaller part of the market, sales of new homes have a bigger impact on the economy because they trigger more economic activity in infrastructure, in schools, in roads, in buying more furniture and things like that. So that'll be interesting to watch. In the past, the Fed expressed concern about some kind of slowdown in housing after a nice post-crisis recovery. So that's also a thing to watch out for. Last thing, we have looking ahead to next week, we have the non-farm payrolls. Always a big thing.
Oh, that's the big one. Yeah, it's always the big new big ticket item for the US economy. So yeah, that'll be interesting to follow that. I know that Yellen, Chair Yellen from the FOMC, talked about a little bit about the employment situation. She always talks about it because that's one of the major concerns. The thing is, I don't know, do we see that there is a slowdown? I don't know, because the numbers were a little bit less impressive in the past couple of months than what they were in the preceding months, but it's still, all in all, it's not that bad. It's doing pretty well, though, or you think otherwise?
Yeah, basically we had an excellent run of 6 months between February and July of over 200,000, and numbers were looking strong, and we had upwards revisions. And in August, we had a big disappointment with only 142,000 jobs gained. And we saw a fall in the participation rate to the multi-year low, multi-decade lows of 62.8%. So this was a big setback, but perhaps it was a one-off. So now we're also looking to see if the past has changed or if data around the past has changed. So we could see an upwards revision for August, especially in the number of jobs gained, and that would provide some kind of sigh of relief. And we are expecting to see a gain of over 200,000 jobs in September, getting us back to the previous trend, which will also be a sigh of relief for the Fed and will be bullish for the US dollar. But we're beginning the expectations from a low point, so if we get a good revision, a small tick up in the participation rate, and at least some kind of tick up in the average hourly earnings in salaries, basically from 2% even to 2.1%, this will all be really positive for the dollar. If we have no upwards revisions, if we have another sub 200K job gain and nothing new on the front of the participation rate and average hourly earnings. Perhaps some people will think that the Fed might slow down, reconsider. Of course, not the end of QE in October, but perhaps the rate hike will be pushed back.
Or maybe we'll start pushing it at a faster pace also once they raise the rates. Obviously, that's also something to consider.
Yeah, if we have a positive figure, it'll raise expectations for a faster rate hike, as we've seen in the last FOMC. And that will be, of course, dollar bullish. So I guess we'll talk about non-farm payrolls more in detail next week. But as it's king of forex trading and part of the Fed's dual mandate for full employment, but... Yeah, but that's sort of a preview, and markets will already begin thinking about it with the jobless claims this week.
All right, excellent. So we have a busy agenda, especially for next week, and also some interesting reports from this week. So, okay, that's it for now. Thank you, Chai, as usual.
Cool, thank you.
Yeah, and thank you all for listening. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion, just drop us a line in our website, forexcrunch.com and tradingenergy.com, or seek us out on Twitter, and we may refer to your comment or question in the next show. So if you like our podcast, give us a 5-star rating in iTunes or subscribe, and spread the good word. That's it. Until next time, this is Lior signing off for your high, saying have a great week and invest responsibly.
For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com, where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make market movers possible.